They're gonna build it.
10, 9.
Who gets to go?
8, 7.
From Carl Sagan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author,
6.
And Robert Zemeckis,
5.
The Academy Award-winning director of Forrest Gump.
You're willing to give your life?
A journey
4.
Into the heart of the universe.
3.
Jodie Foster,
2.
Matthew McConaughey.
1.
We are not alone.
Contact.
Or indeed from the first words of Carl Sagan's original novel, Contact, quoting from William Blake, "Little fly, thy summer's play, my thoughtless hand has brushed away. Am not I a fly like thee, or art not thou a man like me? For I dance and drink and sing, till some blind hand shall brush my wing." The latest in the Culture Shapers analysis and reflections on movies from times past comes from 20 years ago, actually, the 1997 release, of course, of the Rob Zemeckis Contact. And we're delighted, as ever, to be able to welcome Ace director Phil Leonis to share some thoughts and views on a reappraising, a rereading of the Contact movie. Phil, as ever, good to connect with you, good self.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a very interesting process for me revisiting this film.
I enjoyed it when it first came out, having read the book, having appreciated that in terms of Sagan's original text, and I've got to nail my colours to the mast here, I've been a fan of Carl Sagan from back in the day of the 1970s and Cosmos and so on, and I did feel that what he did with Contact was really address a number of key issues. Certainly the need to have a respect for science and appreciation of science when writing science fiction, certainly the role of women in science and their often underestimated role and overlooked, it has to be said, in many ways, roles, and also that classic dichotomy of religion and science and the elements that come through within that field. There were big changes within the movie Contact, as understandably adaptations took place. The character of Ellie Arroway, effectively, in the novel, we see her journey and her passage, having lost her her mother, and not having lost her father, and her mother sort of then, a relationship with her stepfather, etc. There are other characters that come through within this. And of course, directed by Rob Zemeckis, the master of sometimes 30-31 takes, not because he wants to simply repeat the whole thing, and maybe as a director you might want to say one or two things about this, Phil, but the whole precision of wanting to get a fluidity of movement, to actually get takes in one shot, to do a 360-degree take around a room, which by its very nature, and I'm speaking very much as the amateur film appreciator here, necessitates a lot of rehearsals and an awful lot of takes until you actually get it right.
Yes, and then it's about the technical getting it right versus the human getting it right. And there is a degree to which this is the flaw of the film, though it is also what the film is about. As I said, very interesting to be coming back to this movie 20 years later. First of all, because it came out at a time where there were a spate of big budget science fiction films that were futuristic, that dealt with aliens. I mean, we're talking about Men in Black. We're talking about Gattaca. We're talking about The Fifth Element. We're talking about Starship Troopers. And there's a degree to which this almost underwhelmed. And yet 20 years later, the prescience of the movie, it was very forward-thinking in terms of the themes we would be discussing today, and we'll get into this. But also, it is a film where, as we just alluded to, sometimes the flaws might not be the problem with the movie so much as what the movie is about. These techniques that serve to isolate an actor from their own innate instincts, from the human moment, which I'm most interested in capturing as a filmmaker, is also what the movie's about how people get isolated, not only from each other, but from their own instincts. I was friends with, I actually met Mr. Sagan. I was friends with his son back during film school. And I appreciate, of course, what seems to be this setup of the dichotomy versus religion and science. Though it must be said that, and others have said it more brilliantly than I, but that there never really has been a debate between science and religion. It's been a debate between science of now and the science of 2,000 years ago. That both of these, both the Bible and the science of today, were efforts to understand the world around us, the universe around us, and attempting to use our understanding of those realms to the best of our ability at those times. What I love that comes through, at least for me, and I'm curious whether there's any of this for you in watching it, is that, yes, there are these debates about between science and religion, though honestly, there's more intense debates in the film, again, this is very prescient, between practical science and science of inquiry. That's the more contentious debate in the movie. But there is also this idea, I think, that's being subtly expressed, that art might be the bridge between the two, and that instead of being diametrically opposed, science and religion might be the idiomatic pillars upon which human self-expression, i.e. art, is based. Did that come through at all for you in watching it?
On a number of levels. I've got to say, the first time I saw the movie, which was in the cinema back in 97, there were a couple of scenes which I found, I think, emotionally overwhelming sounds a very dramatic phrase, but I did find them, they struck a major resonant chord with me. Possibly because I'd just lost my mother a couple of years earlier, father had died again, and so I was awful from that point of view. But the scene where we see the young Ellie effectively having to cope with the death of her father and the absence there, and also the futility. I mean, there's a wonderful shot of where we see Ellie desperately trying to get the medicine, to reach the medicine in the cabinet. Again, very well put together. And again, looking at some of the other elements that were coming through within that, including, as I latterly found again on subsequent viewings, the fact that the popcorn had been arranged on the floor in the shape of the Big Dipper. And the notion of internet connectivity, and that heartfelt moment where, again, Ellie, as the character, is desperately trying to use her radio to contact, you know, to come back, to connect with that. The sense of loss, the sense of profound loss, in a sense, the notion that actually this is somebody who is a blood connection, a blood relative, who is suddenly gone for you. And suddenly take it away from that, the whole perspective. So I think it hit me on that kind of emotional, visceral level. But equally, in terms of the sense of wonder that we actually go on to see as the movie proceeds, and we don't want to sort of jump too far ahead of ourselves here, I think that's one of the areas in which the connectivity really works for me. I mean, you mentioned Gattaca. We've obviously considered Gattaca previous to this in another edition. Unlike Gattaca, which I thought was, on an intellectual level, fascinating and worked in a number of areas, I thought what Zemeckis had managed to do here, and you could argue, well, that's the backdrop of, you know, his training, his work with Forrest Gump, his work with even Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and so on, that he managed to humanize the thing. And again, I think that notion, a word we'll be mentioning several times during the course of this sequence, the co-creation,
well,
was at the fore.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The conscious co-creation. I don't want to. You just made kind of the hair on the back of my neck stand up in terms of Zemeckis, because I'm suddenly realizing also, you know, Back to the Future, and how all his films are suddenly bridging a past, maybe a mythological past, but a past. You know, in the case of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it's an animated past, but. Are bridging a past with a present that feels somehow corrupt and or at least cacophonous in some way, isolation, you know, very isolatory. And before we leave this visual approach to the film, it is set up very early on where, you know, we start with the cacophony of broadcasts. And as we're pulling back through the decades, the farther we get from Earth, we both we get a little more calm and peace and beauty. But then we also start to feel the real isolation as we go all the way back to the source. And then that reverse, if we can call it a Powers of 10 opening, we then get the reverse of it after we dissolve to the eye of young Ellie. right? Reminding us that every blink we take creates the known universe all around us. It reminds us that millions of galaxies within us. You described the popcorn on the floor, a wonderful symbol of as below, so above. Well, we're also reminded that as within, so without. There are millions of galaxies within us. And that powers of 10 shot is reversed as we head into the house during the can we talk to series of questions and answers, right? The one that culminates in the exchange, can we talk to mom? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, and the biggest radio can't reach that far. So this whole visual motif that seems to tell us that traveling through our own unique isolation, which often surrounds whatever our own unique pain is or our own unique shame, that traveling through that, not avoiding it, not arounding it, traveling through the pain of that isolation is what ultimately offers us the opportunity for contact and connection.
It's interesting when we consider the sort of, and I think it's an intrinsically optimistic movie. That was the message that came across, that despite the fact that we saw the foibles of human existence at work there, also the frustration. I mean, the character portrayed by Tom Skerritt of David Drumlin, who also appears in the book, I think he's given a slightly more sympathetic treatment in the original book than in the movie, where you have that sense of frustration where you're doing all the work and somebody else is taking credit for that work and so on. It also managed to, I think, very effectively, and it's rare that science fiction movies do this, despite the nature of the beast and so on, they did manage to represent the processes of science effectively. And that's undoubtedly, I suspect, due to Carl Sagan's input, to Anne Druyan's input, his wife, and actually makes a cameo appearance in the movie. One or two areas, I mean, I think I had a mild groan with the character played by William Fichter as Kent Clark. I thought, I think I know where they're going in terms of this sort of aspect here. You can argue that the name of Ellie Arroway, E-A-R, the importance of listening and connecting from that perspective. And that undeniable sense, as you've alluded to, Phil, of feeling the need to connect. And we talked about prescience. 20 years ago, long before the social media revolution had kind of reached the stage that we're at now, the notion that people still feel isolated in a world where technologically it's very straightforward to connect.
Well, we're in constant connection, and it's almost to a degree I'm realizing, like the image of being on a subway or a London tube, where you're, or you know, Tokyo, any major city, right, where you're literally pressed up against your fellow human beings, so you act like they're not there. The intimacy is so forced that you almost act like they aren't there to protect yourself, to create a boundary that no longer exists. I was interested in William Fichtner's appearance. I in rewatching this, this character meant a great deal more to me. First of all, through what we learn about Ellie. Remember, we're introduced to Ellie as a young girl with her eye, not her hearing. Her focus is entirely on what she can hear or not hear. And yet we're introduced, so the message is that this is going to be about her opening her eyes. Indeed, she's very interested in what she can hear, so much so that she sees nothing, right? When she meets William Fichtner's character, he says, I think it's great that you listen. Most people don't do that anymore, which is very prescient, all the more so here 20 years later. But Ellie responds, it makes it feel more real. Very interesting, this need to make things feel more real. Yet hearing, especially the way she does it, is a mediated experience. So there's this idea that technology and having things mediated for us makes it feel more real. They start to shake hands, and she hasn't even noticed that he is blind. She literally hears but does not see. And this is interesting, especially if we question later in the film what she does see and whether a journey has even taken place right?
Yeah.
Getting back to Fichtner just for a minute, also some of the other things, he's an interesting and important counterpoint, right, to Matthew McConaughey's character, Palmer Joss, who is literally all eyes. When we first meet him and he's talking to Ellie, he doesn't blink once in that scene. His eyes are all wide, always unblinking. He's writing a book, of course, about how technology is affecting, quote, third world cultures. And so this counterpoint is really important and interesting to me, though I must say I really wonder why William Fichtner's character is not the romantic couple for Ellie, because the actors, Fichtner and Jodie Foster, have actual chemistry, whereas I think it's safe to say, looking at this movie again 20 years later, McConaughey and Foster, not so much so. Oh, well. That's the challenge in casting anybody.
And I think the character of Kent, played by Fichtner, obviously was a kind of amalgam of various parts, as indeed was Palmer Joss. There are several characters in the original novel. We're not talking about adaptation, because clearly there are lots of decisions that need to be made with respect to that. One aspect I would have liked to have seen perhaps more of in the film, which we really only see alluded to in terms of the space station Mir in itself, an interesting definition, because Mir translates from Russian, both peace, as in, and also a period where serfs would rule themselves or peasants would rule themselves, and again that whole notion of
we're going to have to talk about Mir again later, because what I want to talk about is maybe getting a little too far ahead. But you know, there's so much to talk about in this movie, and there's so always a dialectic set up. There's a dialectic not only between these arguments but visually set up. To me, maybe this is just a terrible pun, but the Mir space station sounds a lot like mirror. And we have that wonderful mirror shot you described at the beginning, after Ellie's father dies and she is running to the medicine cabinet. And only at the end do we realize that we've been looking into a mirror. We've been looking into literally another universe, where things are reversed to how they are. When we go to the Mir space station, what's the first thing we see? We see someone upside down. So we'll talk about that again. Something that also occurred just now when you were saying that, Fichtner's character, the character of the blind figure, which is such an archetype going back throughout dramatic history, but one that I think is used in kind of an interesting way, uniquely in this film, where it's not just it takes a blind man to see, that kind of traditional moral, but that everyone from Palmer Joss to Ellie identify so specifically with their way of taking in the world, whatever their particular way is, and we all do this. They identify with it so much, and whatever we identify with might be our strength, but it will at times be our very weakness. The character of William Fichtner, the blind man, has such an obvious, if we can call it, weakness in that he cannot see, that he identifies with no specific sense or way of knowing, and we witness him know the people around him on a variety of different ways, on a variety of different sensory inputs, not just listening. And so I thought that was a very subtle exploration of, again, reminding us to use all the senses at our disposal, all our ways of knowing, empirically and also intuitively.
We spoke about the sequence heading to the mirror, and clearly, again, it's a standard film school technique that shooting with a mirror in any scene is a challenge. Let's have a listen to some of the magic of Alan Silvestri in terms of how he builds up that sense of pathos and the sense of concern with respect to his excerpt from the soundtrack of Contact. It's interesting. We were talking about a few weeks ago about Max Steiner and his work with the Searchers. They have a completely different approach to the music, but nonetheless, I think very effective in terms of how it builds and obviously enhances the emotion, the sense of power that works here, which, of course, is echoed by the signal from outer space, the connection of the very large array, the significance of actually receiving a signal, a source that isn't just based in nature, that actually connects with the whole onset of it's not a pulsar, it's not a phenomenal nature, it's actually a source that suddenly might signify there is intelligent life out there. We have the two words SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and of course CETI, contact with extraterrestrial intelligence.
It's very interesting to me the concept that this entire signal may be intended explicitly for Ellie. You know, that mirror shot, if we can come back to that just as a beginning, as an announcement that, you know, we're not in the universe we think we are. That's what that visually is showing us. We think we've been watching one thing, but really we've been watching a mirrored image of it. And so it calls attention to us as viewers that we're not where we thought we were. And it's followed up immediately upon that realization, right, with the priest telling young Ellie about accepting things as God's will sometimes transcends understanding. And this is right after the death of her father. The signal, if you'll remember, and it leads to some amusing exchanges, especially on the part of, you know, Secretary of Defense and other government officials. But the signal being sent incorporates in it the very first television broadcast of any distance back from the 1936 opening of the Olympic Games in Berlin, where Hitler is addressing the assembled. And I love that the message, everybody takes what the political implications might be, but literally that this message is Hitler talking about the importance of the fatherland is a message that only could be intended for Ellie, because this whole movie could very much be called Fatherland, right? It is about the ways in which her relationship with her father, the death of her father, is informing and maybe even writing the pattern of her entire life. She meets Palmer Joss. Palmer Joss echoes the line that her father says, repeats his line about how if there isn't life out there, that's a lot of wasted space. This immediately leads to a kiss and sex. Now, sex and intimacy are not necessarily the same thing. And indeed, in the afterglow, if we can call it that, Joss opens up about his God experience, which is true intimacy. And that panics Ellie and she rushes off, seeing a shooting star that returns her once again to her father's death. So all of this is about the only kind of contact she's going to know is going to be that which is initiated in some very real way by her father, by a desire to visit the land of her father, the fatherland. It's a very interesting way of looking at this, as if we've gone through the looking glass with Ellie. And the music that you just played to me captures this beautifully, because here's this epic movie of exploration, and that music is the music of intimate, psychological, emotional exploration.
We're going to change tack slightly now, Phil, because Baudrillard, French philosopher of renown, in his concept of postmodernism, talks about the only way in which in the latter part of the 20th century we as human beings could identify ourselves was through the reflections, again, mirror image, that we saw of ourselves through the media. We were virtual symbols adrift in a virtual sea of unreality. And one of the areas that Zemeckis has really developed, and it's almost almost a signature note in many ways, is his use of Geraldo Rivera, Jay Leno, President Bill Clinton, of course, who was around from there. Lots of news stories that were featured in there. Robert Novak. It's almost a kind of roll call of American chat show hosts and commentators from the latter 20th century. And he does that in a sense which, if you don't actually really appreciate what they're saying, there's an awful lot of additional dialogue that's coming through within that whole notion of where we're going, how we're connecting with each other, and so on. It's interesting, again, just returning briefly to the original novel. In the novel, Sagan is quite clear. It's a female president. It's an American female president. It's Madam President in the office of the White House. Clearly, and again, I think the production crew are on record as saying that there was a fortuitous nature that Bill Clinton had been talking about the Mars rock discovery, the discovery of potentially fossilized forms of life that had been discovered on Mars, which maybe indicated that there was extraterrestrial life over and above the planet Earth, which they borrowed extensively to kind of mix and match the things together. It's interesting that although various filmmakers have kind of incorporated actuality events within that whole field, you could go back to Zelig and Woody Allen in one instance, etc., as well as, of course, the aforementioned Forrest Gump. It was a wonderful way, I thought, of, again, bringing that sense of uniformity. The only minor gripe I'd have, and you might say typical from a British perspective, is it was unfortunate that the British newscaster had a bow tie on, because it kind of pandered to a bit of a cliche there, which doesn't really exist. We don't really have our newscasters wearing bow ties. Other than that, lots of fascinating connections and interconnections with, again, that endorsement.
That at least is an authentic depiction of how Americans apparently viewed our British cousins in the media at that time. So at least it shows a bit of authenticity in terms of how we view the world. I find it very interesting, the controversy that surrounds the use of Bill Clinton and these other newscasters that you talk about. CNN, among others, really regret being a part of it because it led very easily to the claim that they were a corporate shill for their sister company Time Warner. And you know, here we are in a time of fake news all of a sudden 20 years later, right, defending themselves against cries of fake news. And understandably they wish maybe they had never become seen as part of an entertainment conglomerate. So that controversy back then certainly, again, was prescient to where we were heading. The fact that the White House really disliked the inclusion of Bill Clinton and that footage, taken fairly, you know, understandably out of context, is interesting. But I do love that it sets it in a recognizable here and now for that audience, so that you can really ask yourself the important questions about what does this movie have to say about me right here and now, not what political message is it going after. And the obvious joke, of course, Alex, is about changing it from a female president in the book to Bill Clinton was nothing rendered that book more science fiction than the idea of a female president, apparently. It's still a science fiction concept, sadly, 20 years later.
We've mentioned Jodie Foster briefly. We've mentioned, obviously, the young Ellie, portrayed by Jenna Malone, who has, again, worked and developed quite a significant career for herself in many ways. She's often touted as being a young Jodie Foster. Indeed, whatever you think of Sucker Punch, again, it led to a whole range of other factors within that. We've talked about William Fichtner, but let's talk a bit about some of the other key... I mean, David Morse, known to me at the time very much as one of the stars of St. Elsewhere, very underrated role as Ted Arroway, the father of Ellie, and yet somebody who, again, we return to, we come back to. We also have, of course, Ed Woods, James Woods as Michael Kitts. Again, working into a wonderful role. And Angela Bassett, of course, fresh from The Bodyguard as Rachel Constantine, which, again, I thought interesting in terms of the choice of name. Constantine, the first Roman emperor who effectively was responsible for Catholicism emerging and running through the ether within that. But there's one other character who comes through who's going to be introduced by the next piece of music, which, again, I think is particularly significant, especially allowing for Jodie Foster's own views that she stated, that she kind of felt that her relationship with this particular character was very analogous to the relationship of Clarice Starling and Hannibal Lecter. Silvestri's opening bars there, which we'll keep on as a bit of a music bed of the primer and the way in which the primer, or the primer, the connection, the Rosetta Stone, which enables the translation of the extraterrestrial message to go to the fourth, to go forth and be developed. And that connection between, of course, the late John Hurt in a role which it's a very important role. It's not a huge role, but it's such a significant role. And you could almost say he's Haddon in plain sight, if one was wanting to use an appalling pun on the whole thing. But again, the character of Haddon as some kind of combination of omniscient observer, of Svengali, of Deus Ex Machina and connection from that perspective, all of those kind of things. Again, Hurt does nail it. Again, people have actually said it's difficult to think of a bad role that John Hurt has actually adopted, but certainly kind of really adds another level to the text. At least it does for me, Phil. I'm not sure about yourself.
Yes. It added the level of heartbreak to this movie that, again, I think anyone who had experienced the loss of a parent would have felt the first time they saw that movie. The loss of John Hurt actually gave me that in watching this. You know, it imbued this whole movie with such a sadness for me because of his great work in other films, but also because of how just scintillatingly perfect he is in this. I want to talk about a few of the characters that kind of circle, if you will, in the orbit around him. Because there are some other wonderful little casting choices. Rob Lowe as the member of the conservative coalition.
Conservative Christian coalition, Richard Rank.
Yeah, such another prescient character, right? This is less than 10 years after Reagan was president. It's 10 years before George W. Bush, 20 years before Trump. But the anti-science, anti-fact, right-wing religious political movement is already shown in this movie as affecting policy. And this is such the interesting snake that is slithering thematically through this movie, is the relationship between science and policy. And that's why the controversy that the White House started about really being upset that Bill Clinton's footage was used, because, of course, that those comments about the Mars rock were based on information that he was given that, yes, this is what these findings mean, which turned out to be scientifically untrue. And so he felt very much hung out to dry. And then to find these comments, again, granted, taken out of context, but to have them immortalized in a movie really apparently upset the president. But what I love about that controversy is it underscores one of the themes of the movie itself, which is that scientists can be blinded by what they want to find, which brings us to Haddon. We meet Haddon, interestingly enough, when Ellie is going after financing to back her SETI project. And one of the criticisms I have of the movie is in a 2.5-hour movie, we certainly had time to see many of her failures. We don't find out that she's spent years doing this and has failed until she's giving her speech at the very last pitch meeting. I wish we could have been really rooting on going, okay, this is her last chance. We know it. But what an interesting introduction to Haddon. the almost holographic video of him with Reagan, the artwork that is hanging behind Ellie, the whole presentation she's giving. Maybe you know what those paintings are. I recognize the Diego Rivera. Lily believes that it's a Bruegel painting behind him. I would love to know, because those are so specifically chosen. I'm sure there is deep resonance with them. But then he's finally introduced as the all-seeing eye in the sky, that private video. So there is so much interesting thematics here. And I think to go further into talking about the performance, the character, I'd like to hear where you land interpretively on whether or not, yes, he answers the question with the Rosetta Stone and makes all this possible, or whether he indeed created all of this to begin with. Is this all a fraud perpetrated by Haddon?
It is one of those almost unanswerable questions. Just dialing back slightly, again, in terms of the significance and the semiotics of the whole piece, I did feel that the first encounter between Ellie Arroway and Haddon, although we don't actually see him, we simply see his acolytes effectively round the large table. In that particular room, there are two elements that came across to me very strongly. First of all, the artwork that's actually in the room are all Soviet pieces of artwork and from Russian painters and designers. Oh. And secondly, the costume choice of putting Jodie Foster's Ellie Arroway character in the traditional turtleneck sweater and jacket that was so much a part of Carl Sagan's on-screen presence. It was a wonderful touch, I thought, to just sort of draw together on that. Now, moving on to that other side of things, ultimately, we're into the F word, the faith word, that whole essence. And again, we're jumping around a little bit with respect to this side of things. But when we have the journey, the development, again, there's a notion of retribution when the David Drumlin character, he's the man who effectively loses his life, and he loses his life to a Christian suicide bomber, somebody who quite clearly is taking a kind of fundamentalist Christian perspective, played, of course, I thought, extraordinarily successfully by Gary Busey's son, of course.
Yes, so, Jake Busey. I'm glad you mentioned him. He was in my notes as well, and this is an important figure to have, especially, again, if we're looking at this from a prescient view of where the role of science, what role science is going to play in public policy. This idea of almost seeing science through a prism of a conspiratorial eye. Did not Jake Busey in this film remind you at least a little bit, perhaps a heightened, exaggerated version, but of some of the people who speak about science in my documentary, The Truth Is Out There?
Absolutely. Hence the reason we thought it was important for a number of reasons, actually. That was one of them, Phil. But again, that connection between the zeal of the newly converted, the zealot, the belief, however myopic that belief might be, that yours is the only way forward. Again, it's interesting that in terms of the characterization of Ellie Arroway, ultimately it's deemed that Devlin was the right person to represent the planet. Of course, we see the interview process, the procedures that are developed within that, and the committee decides to go with Devlin primarily because of his statement, not necessarily held as a belief statement, but his statement that, in the words of Ellie Arroway, he said what the committee wanted to hear. He gave them the answer that they wanted in terms of representing the planet Earth, and at that particular stage being seen as the ambassador to go to develop that. Now, the motivation for that, again, we're left to speculate. It may well be self-aggrandizement. It may be an ego aspect. It may be a range of things. It may well be that Arroway was seen as too mercurial a character. There's a wonderful phrase going back to the notion of when Kent's character, played by Fichter, says, try not to be too confrontational, to which the response is, what, me confrontational? What do you mean? And it's It's played for laughs in a sense, but you get that sense that there is a frustration and an energy that's there that effectively does carry with it on another level the zeal of the scientist, the zeal of somebody who actually wants to discover, wants to find out things and wants to develop our place in the universe.
So the zealot who blows this up, it again becomes very interesting. And again, I mean, it's impossible to be looking at this 20 years later and not to be shaking at times, because the zealot who perverts the wonderful Apollo astronaut's phrase, "What we do for the good of all mankind," perverts that phrase before blowing it up. "What we do for the goodness of all mankind," and this basic distrust of science that becomes violent and destructive. We're seeing lawsuits right now in this country about perhaps violence being instigated at events by the man who would be elected our president, a billionaire who distrusts science. And here again, at the center of contact, you have a billionaire who uses science, but seems to use anything to achieve his aims. And one wonders, right, did this need to be blown up to prevent Drumlin from representing all mankind on a journey that was intended only for a perfect willing dupe, i.e. Ellie? It's a fascinating concept to go around. The meeting with Haddon, by the way, up in the airplane, you should feel fortunate. He hardly lands for anyone. That meeting from its very beginning is very Lynchian. It feels like a scene out of a David Lynch movie, not a Robert Zemeckis movie. Very appropriate since the scene introduces one of David Lynch's most beloved stars, right? John Hurt, the Elephant Man. It's also very Prisoner-esque. It has some visual connotations of Patrick McGoohan's The Prisoner. In that scene, transcending dimensionality is discussed about, and this concept that human evolution means our ability to function on multiple dimensions. And this brings us back to this concept to me, that the answer to so many of these seemingly either or questions the movie poses, the answer is art. The answer is storytelling, because this is what opens us to transdimensionality and to conscious co-creation.
We mentioned one of the rationales for Your Good Self being our co-presenter, co-creator of this particular episode. It would be most remiss of us not to talk about the eldest son of an educator and diplomat, a former NBC television director before being drafted into the United States Army in 1967, and somebody who has been in The Truth Is Out There, a very key part of The Truth Is Out There, and, of course, The Lady Killers. We heard his voice at the start of the opening clip to this production, Tucker Smallwood.
Yes, and another personal connection, of course, is Lily Holloman.
Indeed.
Her first film was this. She has two quick scenes, blink
yep.
and you'll miss her,
yes.
in the film. But she plays one of the cousins that Ellie goes to live with after the death of Ellie's father. And again, talk about prescience, talk about how art can introduce you at the very least to your own personal patternings on a multidimensional sense. Lily, who watched some of this with me, was struck by the fact that her first movie 20 years ago would be about a girl seeking her deceased father. And that has been very much the path that Lily herself has been on much of her adult life. But so fascinating that two, we could argue, of the most significant creative collaborators and more, and friends and partners in crime that I have had these last two decades would be on screen in this movie, Contact. It also, here's a movie that's showing some of my personal patterning towards me. But Tucker himself, fascinating figure. We've talked about him before as an actor. he had a difficult time getting cast until he was finally cast in a science fiction milieu, because casting directors would say, Tucker, we like you very much, but we don't know what to do with you. And then the thought was, oh, maybe in the future there will be black people like you. I don't know what that means, what the phrase black people like you meant, but he was actually told that by casting people. And then he became identified with science fiction. And Contact is perfect because it brings to bear both his innate leadership that he carries with him, his innate gravitas, but also his innate availability and compassion and decency.
There are no words, as both Ellie Arroway and indeed Alan Silvestri make out, when the journey is finally taken. Indeed, whether it's a journey of the mind into inner space and to outer space. I think at the time a number of critics felt a little bit let down slightly by the final denouement at Vigia, which, as we said earlier, we're never quite sure whether it actually occurred or didn't occur, apart from, of course, that classic item. It's a bit like rolling away the tombstone from the Garden of Gethsemane and actually seeing that there is no sign here, the 18 hours of static that were recorded by the device.
That is, to me, the problem with the movie. The 18 hours of static is the reason that we need to revisit this movie because other people aren't doing it. I think it's the 18 hours of static is the very problem. If they had avoided that, and this is sometimes, to me, a flaw with Zemeckis in his career, is that he can't ultimately embrace ambiguity. He can't ultimately embrace the basic truth of that which is unknowable. Exploring the unknowable is mystery. A mystery cannot be solved. That's what makes it a mystery. And exploring it, as Kubrick understood, is what opens us. By giving the 18 hours of static, it puts it, it tilts. It tilts the pendulum in the direction of an interpretation. And I think that is the weakness. Now, at the same time, the film might have suffered worse box office had it been truly ambiguous. But all these years later, it would be remembered and revered in a way, I think, that it really is deserving of. And that ambiguity would have led the way. But ambiguity is very tricky because, as we know, you pay your money, you want a story with an ending. But it is about, as storytellers, giving people the story, not necessarily they want, but the story that they deserve. And the ambiguity of it would have been really, really a beautiful thing. The ending line that you quoted about there are no words is such a beautiful capper linguistically to a movie that so often is about semantic debates, is it not? One person says that sounds like faith, and Ellie says, no, that's just a sense of adventure. She says she denies God because there is no proof, but Palmer asks her if she can prove that she loves her father. And so it's a wonderfully, I don't know, a very effective and charming way of showing us that most debates really boil down to semantics. Hmm. And so how do you get to a place where there are no words? Well, for that, again, you need art. That's why we have art, to explore those things that transcend words.
We know there's a long and regretful history of the Academy Awards ignoring science fiction movies. It was Contact that is nominated for one Oscar. That was indeed for Best Sound, a joint package with Randy, Tom Johnson, Dennis Sands and William Kaplan. It had a nomination for Jodie Foster for the Golden Globes in 1998, Best Performance by an Actress in a Motion Picture. Picked up a large number of science fiction, fantasy and Annie Awards and so on, Blockbuster Entertainment Awards. Do we feel, again, it's one of those areas where, again, 20 years later, we're still actually saying that the Academy Award people do not understand science fiction? They don't get it. They're not prepared to take that leap of faith to actually believe that we can actually have a better future and so on? Or is it just a case of, well, that's the way things will always be, and science fiction films are simply the westerns of our contemporary culture.
Well, I think, first of all, if a movie's prescient, if a movie's forward-thinking, it's very difficult for it to be appreciated fully upon its initial release. That's the first thing. Yes, science fiction has never been the favorite, but isn't that part of it? That if it is forward-thinking, be it dystopic or utopian or anywhere in between, if it's forward-thinking, that is going to be a film that requires time. And, you know, it's a political campaign. Awards campaigns are political campaigns. They require building up a certain mass of energy behind them. But also, you know, I think it's unfair to say that the Academy never will. Gravity was quite hailed at the Oscars, a science fiction film. So I just think, again, it's a case of being prescient. But I also think it's a case where it might have been difficult to fall in line behind any of the key creative figures. Performance-wise, I think people felt like Jodie Foster had already had her due. Robert Zemeckis had won already for Forrest Gump, a movie that even just a few years later was already seeming to not be quite the work people thought that it was when they fell in love with it. And so it's a political campaign, and that's going to be difficult for any film that's prescient. May I point out one other question that I have that could be seen as a flaw with the film, and it's something that relates back to this idea of the 18 hours of static. The concept that would be the only part of the report that would draw someone's attention strikes me as odd, because there is so much built up in the movie about how she needs to sit in that safety chair. And then she complains because a safety chair was not part of the diagram. And they said, well, we have to make certain alterations as, you know, a caveat to safety. So she sits in the chair. Then she's on her journey. And what happens? She has to unbuckle herself and get out of that chair just in the nick of time as that chair is drawn up to the roof of the capsule and is demolished. So I want to know what happened to the chair when they found the capsule, because it was only a millisecond, right? How in a millisecond, if they found her on the floor, did she unbuckle and did that chair get destroyed? That would certainly seem to be another discrepancy between the concept of time and the report, and there's no no reference to it. Perhaps. And that seems sloppy to me on the part of the filmmakers.
Perhaps the Einstein-Rosen bridge, the mini black hole, can connect from that point of view. Two final questions, Phil. In terms of the piece we alluded to earlier, did you see that connection that Jodie Foster made between Hannibal Lecter and Clarice Starling and Haddon and Arroway as being a kind of similar thing? It was something that I think certainly appeals to Foster in terms of her interpretation of the role.
Yes, I do. I mean, I think both characters for her are confronting woundings from childhood, right? Mm. And at the very least, this figure of Haddon at best is recognizing that those woundings are what is driving her and makes her relentless and remarkable. At best, that is what he's doing. At worst, if you'll pardon the pun, he's cannibalizing them for his own gain.
The film itself is dedicated to Carl Sagan, with the two words "for Carl" echoed into the whole place. And I think in terms of the screenplay, I'll quote once again, as we started from the original Contact narrative, Chapter 3, White Noise, where Sagan quotes from John Keats' Ode on a Grecian Urn, "Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter." Maybe that's a key thing in terms of that faith aspect and the notion that we are all co-creators, co-travellers, inner space and outer space. Phil, it's been a delight as ever. We look forward to further explorations of the culture shapers and culture makers and so on. Any final thoughts as we end with the end credits of Contact and that belief that's there? Again, the line of Palmer Joss, is tempted to actually go into maybe some connection with Philip K. Dick's The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch in terms of the religious aspect, but that's perhaps another discussion. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with us on the movie Contact?
Well, we could go on for hours. I mean, there is so many references to others. There's references to Arthur C. Clarke's 2010 novel. But I will end again, since a theme seems to have emerged about this idea of the importance of art as a bridge between the seemingly insoluble debates that we find ourselves mired in. Ellie's epiphany cannot be described because any individual's epiphany is simply that. It's an individual epiphany. This sense in this movie that, again, institutions seem to have failed us in the primary function of inspiring us to ask the question why. Not how, but why. When Ellie witnesses her celestial event, what does she remark? She remarks that they should have sent a poet because, again, she has no words. And so it's again, this importance of art and how prescient that is, because here we are 20 years later at a time where it seems like younger generations don't watch movies. They don't love movies. And that's a shame if for no other reason than movies, through their unique relationship of time and compression of time and exploration of time, open us to multidimensionality. And as we just revealed, no movie is the same for any two viewers. You create the movie Contact as you watch it, and I do the same. And we will create a different movie of Contact the next time we watch it.